Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Caritas Lebanon launches an emergency appeal for help as it tries to lend assistance to arriving refugees from Syria. That amid fears that the violence is spilling across the border. And the United Nations Food and Agriculture Agency calls for a coordinated response to food and water insecurity in the Middle East and North Africa. We talk to an expert. And the Obama administration's healthcare strategy against religious freedom, church institutions take legal action. Caritas Lebanon has made an emergency appeal to partner agencies in the Caritas network to help meet the growing needs of increasing numbers of Syrian refugees coming into the country. Caritas estimates that as many as 30,000 Syrian refugees are currently in the country, though official figures put their number at some 26,000. The president of Caritas Lebanon, Father Simon Fadoul, told me his Catholic aid agency is coordinating its response to the refugee crisis with the United Nations Agency for Refugees, or UNHCR, by offering medical care and providing blankets, cooking utensils, supplies for personal hygiene, and other items of necessity.
Well, the official numbers issued by the UNHCR, although so many Syrian refugees refused to give their names and to be listed, the official number is 26,000. So I would say certainly the number is a few more thousand higher, you know, whether in the north or in the Bekaa Valley or all over Lebanon, because they are now spread all over because of the presence of their family members all over Lebanon, especially the Syrian workers who were working in Lebanon. And they did bring their families, or they had members of their families fleeing to meet them here.
So where are these refugees right now, and what are their greatest needs in terms of shelter, food, medical care?
Well, all of the above. However, unfortunately, what's been happening in Lebanon the last few days has shifted a bit the attention of them. But we, as Caritas, for instance, we intervene next to them in terms of medical assistance and food and the non-food items like hygiene items and stuff like this. In terms of shelter, the vast majority are still housed in private homes, whether with their relatives or with other private people. Some of them even have rented out, you know, apartments or homes, especially in the Bekaa area. And in the north, this is because that's where their presence is quite intensive out there.
But I'm sure that so many of them probably escaped with just the clothes on their back. So how are they?
In the north, in the Akkar area, the High Commission for Relief is mandated by the Prime Minister to conduct the work along with UNHCR and all the NGOs who are there. We are one of them. We coordinate the activities. But in the Bekaa, the High Commission was not mandated for whatever reasons, most probably political reasons between the Lebanese and the Syrian government. So it's all our work as NGOs, and UNHCR is present in some places. We go in places where actually no other NGO has been there, because we feel there is great need there and a great level of poverty. And very few intervene in that area. It's in the northern Bekaa. It's close to the border with the Homs area, which is, you know, the hottest place in Syria in terms of war zone. What the organizations are providing, actually, depending, clothing, food, medical supplies, hygiene items, all things. Now it's kind of summertime, so thank God for this, because yani, you don't need to spend so much on heating oil. But the needs are great. The resources are not much, are scarce, especially in the light of what's been happening in Lebanon the last few days. So people are afraid now, you know what I mean.
Yes, in fact, we've seen some very disturbing developments that the Syrian violence is spilling over into Lebanon. We've seen pro-President Assad supporters and anti-Assad elements taking up arms, particularly in Tripoli in the north and now recently in Beirut, the capital. How worried are you that this could really get out of control of the authorities?
Well, we are, let's say, 120% worried. And we are extremely worried, to be honest. We don't want to see the page, the war page reopening again in Lebanon. However, the last few days have witnessed a preview of something similar, which is very scary to the whole society. We are all on our nerves. We are all awaiting. We are in a period of wait and see. We feel it's the kind of a confessional war is taking over some places. We're afraid things will be let go. We hope not. There are so many white people around. Unfortunately, also there are so many paid hands, people for hire, who are trying to create troubles and make clashes among people. So it's a very delicate situation. And I am like sitting in my office, and at every minute I'm waiting for, getting the news, receiving a bit of news to see which road was cut, which road was reopened, what's going on there, what's going on here, because, it's a very worrisome situation.
What is being done to prevent more violence?
Well, the Lebanese government, I don't know if they can they have much to do, unfortunately, since it has proven not to be in control of the whole of Lebanon. They are trying. Certainly, the Lebanese army is doing its role. The security forces are doing their role.
Father Fadul is especially critical of inflammatory rhetoric among Lebanese politicians.
The problem is the politicians in Lebanon, unfortunately, we all feel, and even yesterday the Minister of Interior said it on TV, we all feel that the language they are using, the threatening language and expressions, the speech they are using is not the peace-building speech. It's rather the war-starting speech, and which is worrying all of us. And that's why we all are calling on politicians to appease the speech, the talks, and to start thinking positively and speaking positively so peace can reign. Are there among them people who are maybe hired or paid to do so? I don't know. I'm not going to go into politics. But this is not something new to our Lebanese scene, a political scene. Everything is possible. Now, the government is trying, but I doubt they can do much things. I doubt it.
There was another episode which we saw on May 20th when two prominent Sunni sheikhs were killed at an army checkpoint. About two dozen soldiers are now under investigation for that murder. What is the link here to the other disturbances that we've seen in the country?
Well, basically, everything is possible. We live in a world of possible. And we do have plenty of trust and confidence in our Lebanese army. However, is this an individual incident? Is it an accident? Is it a plan? Is the army at fault? Are they faulty? We don't know. The investigation is going on now. It's underway. We are all awaiting to see what the investigation will reveal. In all cases, the way they were shot, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. We don't know the particulars of the whole situation, what went on, but the way we saw the pictures on TV and stuff, certainly is not acceptable, humanly speaking now, and legally speaking. Now, what is the situation? To be honest, the army's command has taken a very noble step. They have apologized publicly, and they have appointed an investigation team of high officers, and they've started the investigation. They've already put under arrest a couple dozen soldiers and officers to be investigated. I don't think they can do much more than this at the time now, at the time being. We have to wait and see what happens.
Lebanon is also home to some 300,000 Palestinian refugees of the Arab-Israeli conflict who live in camps which are largely off-limits to Lebanese authorities, though some are widely suspected of maintaining weapons caches. Scenes from the 3.5-month-long clashes between militants and Lebanese security forces at Narb al-Barid camp outside Tripoli in 2007 are never far from anyone's mind. So within this scenario, can Lebanon afford to receive rising numbers of refugees from conflicts across the region?
No, we cannot. We cannot. We cannot continue to afford this. It's been really burdensome on all of us, all of the Lebanese population, on the complexity of our demographic composition and on the balance among communities, on the social welfare of everybody. We do not accept the conditions in which our brothers, the Palestinians, live in the camps. Socially and humanly, it's not an acceptable condition, to be honest, but this is the situation. We have, on the other hand, a large percentage of Lebanese people who are under the poverty level, living under the poverty level. We're talking about the poverty level has reached 35 to 39% in Lebanon. You have about 12 to 15% under the poverty line, you know, which is unacceptable as well. Now we have the Syrian refugees.
Faced with these factors, the Lebanese government has indicated it wants to stem the influx of Syrian refugees, something that Father Fadul says is all but impossible given Lebanon's porous borders.
The government strengthened a little bit the grip and they said, we want to try not to receive refugees, but they cannot because all our borders, the official border may not be open, but the unofficial borders are open between Syria and Lebanon. You know, it's all our eastern border, all of it is with Syria, and it's all infiltrated, and it's not common knowledge. I was once visiting with the refugees up there, and I witnessed the escape of two families, two women with about 12 children, you know, running from across the Syrian border. They had crossed the river and came, you know what I mean? And they fled into safety. Nobody can tell them, not the army, nobody can tell them go back. Go back where? To be killed? Also, it's on our conscience. We are in a very critical position. That's why we as Caritas, we have made an emergency appeal to our Caritas network partners so that we can continue to do our work. We hope the fighting ceases as soon as possible, whether in Syria or in Lebanon. We don't get into this, certainly. And we have to pray. We have to intensify prayers. We are in the month of May. We have to ask, really, intercession of Our Lady of Lebanon, Mary, Our Lady of Lebanon, to help us.
With all this going on, you can't help but also think about Pope Benedict's visit to Lebanon this September. What are local church officials doing to ensure that that visit goes ahead on schedule and that it goes well?
Well, preparations are underway. There is a central committee that is coordinating here in Rome. Things seem okay. I don't know, would anything happen to prevent this? God forbid. We don't know. In our area of the world, this is a bit early to talk about. That's why we have to arrange everything and hope for the best, and that's what they are doing. In other areas of the world, in the Western world, you can plan 1 year ahead, but here you cannot. You have to have a plan B all the time, you see what I mean? Now, what kind of plan B does the committee have? I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not a member of that committee. But I hope everything goes on well and the visit will take place on time, and we are very excited to receive the Pope amongst us, and we feel that it's an additional blessing to Lebanon.
Father Simon Fadoul is the president of Caritas Lebanon. And the escalating violence in the region isn't the only security concern there. In our second report, we hear how climate change and other factors may also be having an impact on security. As the Middle East and North Africa undergo sweeping social and political changes, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, is urging governments to work together to guarantee sustainable food and water supplies in the region. While calling the region one of the world's driest and vulnerable to extreme climatic events, the FAO says natural resources degrade under these conditions and further impact food production. Also impacting on food and water security, a high population growth rate, which has increased unemployment and widespread poverty. Plus, the UN agency points out that the region is a big importer of food and major importer of cereals, making it vulnerable to the effects of volatile food prices that have marked the recent global economic and financial crisis. An FAO official responsible for the Near East, Mujahid Ashouri, told me the impact of water scarcity on food production is perhaps the major concern for countries in the region. And some scenarios indicate climate change could mean a 20 to even 50% reduction in rainfall in coming years.
One of the greatest, and it was discussed and highlighted as a very serious concern, is water scarcity, which is already a major concern. And all scenarios say that with climate change, this may even be worse. I mean, there are talks about, by reduction from 20 even to 50% in rainfall, which means it's going to affect the region. And when we say water scarcity, we mean, of course, land resource limited productivities and limited production. And of course, you link this again to one of the major concern again and link to this is food security in the region.
Well, tell us a little bit about the food security issue there. I mean, you've got also a very high population growth rate in the region, urban development and so on, poverty. These are all exacerbating the food insecurity situation.
Yes, that's right. Population growth is one of the issues. And linked to this, of course, there is, of course, maybe you, it was known to all. I mean, this related again to a major issue in all the region, which is unemployment and mainly youth unemployment. And now when we talk about agriculture and food security, we see this also as an entry, let's say, point for providing food, but also in providing jobs through agriculture and food security. For the moment, I mean, when we talk about food security in the region, we are mostly a region where it's importing its food. There are countries first in the world, for example, importing wheat, like Egypt. And, of course, I mean, when you see what's happening in all over the world and the resources that are limited in the region, we believe that within years, things are going to increase. And this is, of course, is related to what you've heard, I mean, for the last few years about this soaring food prices. And then, of course, I mean, if you talk a little bit about job unemployment and less jobs plus increasing of prices, of course, this is some of the elements which are related to food security or food insecurity in the region. And most of the time we feel like the poor and the children and women are most affected when it comes to food security in the region.
Now, before you were talking about the issue of water, the availability of water, that is also obviously an issue of national security in the region, an issue which can and has sparked wars between countries. Where is water of the most concern?
Yeah, water, as you said, I mean, it's a major concern. I mean, and this is where we are trying now to talk a little bit on transboundary, for example, water resources or transboundary programs. And the idea on this, it's a little bit FAO is trying to help and to find solution developing these transboundary programs and coming up with programs that go beyond one country. And we are talking now about bilateral or sub-regional or regional programs And when it comes to water and water management, it's one of the issues that is being discussed between between countries of the region.
Can you give me some concrete examples? You're talking about transboundary water.
Yes, the Nile is one of them. I mean, the Nile, as you know, I mean, there are 9-10 countries that they are involved in this. And when you talk about upper and downstream, Egypt is a country which is getting most of its water, of course, from the Nile. And now, I mean, how to interact and make sure that the upstream, downstream, first of all, I guess, relationships and water management related issues are taken in consideration. This is an example where a lot of programs, FAO is supporting, of course, to develop appropriate policies and strategies for this.
There have been some very imaginative farming projects which have popped up across some of the wealthier nations in the region. I'm thinking of Saudi Arabia, the Gulf area, which make agriculture ecologically sustainable. But can those sorts of practices be realistically put into place in a wider area there?
Yes, but that's true. That was initiated some time, and there is a lot of studies that they are ongoing. But most of the issues that are raised within this is sustainability, because most of the time when you see, for example, programs, we have to look a little bit how viable are for the long term. So, yes, I mean, now there are even issues on collaborating within the region. And as I mentioned, now you can even run programs maybe of agriculture outside the country within cooperation between countries. And, for example, if you take Sudan and some of the GCC countries or Egypt, there are ongoing collaboration how to produce even food beyond the boundaries of the country.
Now, of course, we've been seeing this so-called Arab Spring throughout the region. How is that impacting the availability of food and water in the region and consequently populations?
Yeah, I mean, it's affecting. I mean, of course, I mean, it's affecting, maybe affecting reduction in production and maybe even affecting reduction in jobs in the market. And all these are directly linked to food security in the region. But again, maybe it's an opportunity, as we see it also, that it may provide maybe a platform for member countries to collaborate and to coordinate maybe efforts. And that's how we see it. From one side, maybe there is a constraint, we hopefully for a short term, but maybe for the long term, it will give space for countries to collaborate and coordinate efforts for a better maybe implementation of programs at sub-regional or regional level.
But is that a realistic goal when you're thinking here of some countries which don't actually even possess fully functioning and democratic governments?
No, I think, as I said, I mean, we talk a little bit about the short term and long term. I guess we see it really as an opportunity. And I've seen maybe even outside the region, donors, potential donors are looking into this and financial institutions. And I do believe that maybe in the region, there is an opportunity for outsider as well as for member countries to find out some kind of understanding for common, let's say, concern. And these could be implemented together.
So what has the FAO and these countries, which meet on a regular basis every few years to discuss the food and agriculture concerns, what progress has been made over the past couple of years? And what areas are you looking into for the future?
I guess the most important thing, I mean, for countries to come together, you know that there is a technical side of it and then a ministerial segment. And I guess this is a platform, an opportunity, first of all, to discuss what are the priorities of the region as a whole. And there was an agreement already between member countries and minister level. What are the priorities that should be considered in the medium term? I guess this is one important thing. The second thing is really to develop and implement projects and programs in line with these priorities, which means we prioritize. We don't just go for any project or for any priority. And the third thing, now that we see it as maybe an issue which is under discussion and hopefully it will lead to some concrete, let's say, delivery, is a little bit some what we call mobilizing resources. And we talk a little bit about human and financial resources. We're even talking about a regional trust fund which could be used within the region to develop programs for poor countries and to develop also programs between countries.
Within that, then, what are your, what would be some priorities, priority projects that the community and the FAO would be willing to invest in?
First of all, I guess what we've heard in food security, when we talk about food security, of course, it goes beyond agriculture. There are many stakeholders, how to involve stakeholders within food security to come up with appropriate policies, but not to stay at level of policies or really to develop strategies and action plans. This is one thing. The second, now we are trying a little bit to develop also strategies to tackle a little bit these impacts of climate change and what are the appropriate strategies for this. I guess this is we heard a lot. And then when it comes to degradation of land resources, what are the activities or what are the programs and the strategies to consider to sustain, let's say, the land resources, which means production for agriculture, and, of course, to reduce also food insecurity in the region. So these are a few of many discussions, and the ministers, they will discuss together and maybe agree on what to do in the coming few years.
Mujahid Ashouri is an FAO official responsible for the Near East. And in our final story today, Catholic leaders in the United States this week filed lawsuits in federal court on behalf of dioceses, schools, and health care agencies opposing the Obama administration's mandate that religious employers provide workers birth control and other coverage which violates their religious beliefs. U.S. bishops are also planning a national campaign for religious freedom in the 2 weeks leading up to the July 4th Independence Day holiday. Emily Hardman, the communications director for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, spoke to Charles Collins about the move.
What you're seeing is the greatest assault to religious liberty that you've ever seen. And with these additional lawsuits being filed, you see the great strengthening of the claims and the stand for religious liberty. It's very significant that these people have joined forces. There are now 22 separate lawsuits and over 60 plaintiffs that are represented. And this isn't just Catholic institutions. There's also evangelical and Protestant universities as well. So it's very clear that this isn't just a Catholic issue, that this is a religious liberty issue and this is a freedom issue, that the government shouldn't be able to force religious institutions to violate their faith or pay a severe fine.
The health care law itself has been taken to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is now deciding whether or not this individual mandate in the law is constitutional. Are these two issues, the individual mandate and the religious liberty, intertwined, or are they separate issues?
Absolutely, they're entwined in the fact that this is part of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Therefore, if the whole Obamacare gets struck down, then the HHS mandate automatically, by default, gets struck down, and it's a huge victory for religious liberty. Now, if the entire Affordable Care Act doesn't get shut down, if it doesn't get ruled unconstitutional, then our cases still get to move forward.
Emily Hardman, the communications director for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.